Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday afternoon. This hour of the program, the huge number of unaccompanied minors who are trying to enter the U.S. from Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador. Today, the president asked for even more money in emergency relief to help stem the tide. He's asking for $3.7 billion. The White House wants to place additional immigration judges on the border to help expedite cases. Yesterday, the White House Press Secretary Josh Earnest said that most of these young people will not be likely to qualify for humanitarian relief and will be deported. Doris Meisner is with us this hour of the program. Doris is former commissioner of the U.S. Immigration and Naturalization Service. She's now senior fellow at Migration Policy Institute, where she directs the U.S. immigration policy work. She focuses on the role of immigration in America's future and on administering the nation's immigration laws, systems, and government agencies. As commissioner of the INS from 1993 to 2000, she reformed the nation's asylum system, improved naturalization and other services for immigrants, shaped new responses to migration and humanitarian emergencies, and strengthened cooperation with Mexico, Canada, and other countries. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Doris during the course of the hour. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and you can also find us on Twitter at @KDunnShow. Doris Meisner, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Let's talk first about the causes for the migration. You have written about this. There are many causes. Can you outline what they are?
Well, there are immediate causes and there are longer-term causes. Fundamentally, of course, these our countries, we're talking now about Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador. Those are the three major, the countries from which the largest share of these young people are coming to the United States. I mean, these are countries where people face desperate conditions, and not only are they desperate from the standpoint of poor economies and lack of opportunity and high levels of poverty, they also are countries that have become increasingly violent, where gangs and cartels are prevalent, and gangs in particular have targeted young people for recruitment, and it's young people face, you know, dangerous circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, those are conditions that have been in existence for quite a long time. I mean, there is not anything that we're aware of that has changed dramatically that would correlate with the spike in the numbers of young people coming to the United States in recent months. So although we have in the immigration system experienced migration by children without parents for many decades, I mean, this is not something new. What's new here is the very large numbers and the rapid escalation of those numbers since last fall.
And we don't really understand why we're seeing such a huge spike since last fall, Doris?
Well, I think we have some ideas. Information is always incomplete. I mean, you never know everything that you want to know, but I think we know enough to know what's going on here. And there have been more and more pieces of information coming from interviews with the migrants themselves, as well as what we know about these kinds of migration emergencies. I think what's happening here is always a combination of circumstances. It certainly is conditions in these countries. But what has seemed to be the pivotal factor is that we in the United States have a law, I mean, a statute, a requirement for how we respond to child migrants. And that statute. It's called the Anti-Trafficking Victims Protection Act. It was passed in 2008, and it requires that we treat young people under the age of 18 coming to the United States illegally. We treat them differently from adults so that they have, when they come, the right to a hearing before an immigration judge and the right to due process, representation by attorneys, if at all possible, in order to determine whether they have a claim to stay in the United States, whether they are eligible for refugee status.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a completely defensible position to be in. This is a good law. It was passed in 2008. It was signed by President Bush. It had strong bipartisan support. But it requires the hearing before an immigration judge, which is a real bottleneck in our immigration system. Our immigration judge functions have not been funded for many years in the way that the enforcement functions of Border Patrol along the border have been funded. And so as a result, we have very long backlogs in the court dockets for these and other immigration cases.
I see.
That means that when young people come in the numbers that we've now seen, they are released. Most of them have family members in the United States. And they're released with what's called a notice to appear. They're required to go to an immigration hearing before a judge. But in many parts of the country, that hearing is, in all parts of the country, that hearing is at least a year away. And in many parts of the country, that hearing may be as much as 2 or 3 years
away. Oh, my goodness.
Yes. And so what that creates is a situation where people, if they get here, they're going to be united with family members, and by the time that hearing comes, some of them won't show up at the hearing. Even those who do, frankly, it's unlikely that if they're determined to not be eligible for protection, it's unlikely that they will actually be returned to their countries. And that has gotten out, as word of mouth does,
right,
in immigrant communities, to be seen as a permit to be in the United States.
I see.
It's not a permit to be in the United States. What it is a notice for when your hearing takes place.
I see.
But, you know, the experience for people is that they've basically now gotten themselves into a much better place than they were when they were in a poor village in Honduras with the danger of gangs every day when they go to school.
So, Doris, why is it that many of them will have family members spread all over the United States, and yet they did not come with their family members initially to the United States? Why are they separated?
Well, they're separated because of this much bigger issue of illegal immigration and of our inability as a country to resolve the unworkability of our current immigration laws and system. These are people that mostly have family members who are unauthorized.
Mm.
Those family members, those parents, generally, either one parent or both parents, came to the United States probably years ago. I mean, they're about, of the unauthorized population in the United States, more than 60% of them have been here for more than 10 years. So we're talking about a long-standing population. And they will have, in these circumstances, left young children behind in the care of grandparents or other family members, or one parent came and one parent is still in Guatemala, say, or El Salvador. And, you know, the years have gone on, and the children are now getting older and becoming teenagers, and they, as with any family and any immigration situation, want to be together.
Mm-hmm.
So that when you have the kinds of conditions in home countries where it's getting more and more dangerous and you have one or more parents or other close relatives in the United States, and you start to hear that other people who came have been able to be with those family members, that then creates a dynamic which has brought about this kind of an escalation in the numbers.
I see. The one thing, the image that stays on my mind, Doris, as a parent or just as somebody who cares about children, it is hard not to be really saddened by these stories of these very young children walking 1,000 miles with all that they can encounter, all the dangers on such a journey, to think that the dangers at home are worse than sending your young child on that kind of a journey just is dumbfounding, isn't it? It's hard to take that in.
It's very hard to take that in. And frankly, for us and the way we live, most of us live, it's unthinkable. But it is not unique. I mean, we have seen throughout the years and in other circumstances around the world where people are so desperate that they will take the chance of sending their children in a defenseless circumstance someplace else in the hope that there might be a better future. And that is certainly part of what is going on here. Now, another part of what is going on here is these kinds of circumstances exploited by smugglers and traffickers who, for very large amounts of money, are telling people that if they turn their children over to them, they will get them here. And those smuggling fees are probably, from the best information that's available, in the neighborhood of $5,000 to $7,000. That's a very large amount of money. There are examples of people who have turned over the deed to their farm or their whatever small land holdings they might have in order to help finance a journey like this for one or more of the young people in the family. And the smugglers, under these circumstances, are able to give pretty strong guarantees. In other words, their word, regardless of the dangers of the journey, and the dangers are every bit as intense as you're describing, but they are able to say reliably that if they get those children to the border and the children are turned over to the Border Patrol, there will be an effort then, I mean, a requirement that they be put into the hands of social service agencies. In this case, the Department of Health and Human Services takes custody after 72 hours and works to place them with a relative or a parent in the United States pending the hearing that we've just talked about before an immigration judge. And so even though it is terribly dangerous and risky, and we have no idea how many children do not make it, there certainly are a substantial number who do not make it. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, thousands are making it and are experiencing being reunited with their families. Mm-hmm. And that ultimately is a risk that many have been willing to take in the name of a better future.
Mm-hmm. The White House saying today that they want $3.7 billion in emergency relief for this situation. You have written about upfront hearings, meaning that the unaccompanied children wouldn't be released immediately to family members, that they, pending a decision on their eligibility to remain here, they would be a special, pretty much immediate, as fast as immediate can be under these circumstances. Will the president's request for this money include upfront hearings? Are people in favor of upfront hearings? Or it's hard to figure out what everybody's in favor of these days, what needs to be done about it, right?
Yeah, exactly. Well, I was very pleased to see in the appropriations request that you're talking about, it's a very large request, and it has, by and large, money that's to be allocated for shelter and for Health and Human Services to provide custody arrangements for these large numbers. But there's also an important element of that request for immigration courts and judges and new judge teams. They're asking for $64 million to be given to the Department of Justice for those purposes. That is a very important element of the response, because it would allow for hearings to be done quickly. And, you know, we're not talking here about just rushing people through and denying them any kind of due process or rights. What we really are talking about is the ability to carry out the hearings, the ability to implement this anti-trafficking law in a way that is consistent with the principles and values that it represents, which is that if people are in need of protection and can qualify for refugee status, they should get it. But also, if they're not, they should be returned. And so we're really talking about making it possible to make that decision at the outset, mm-hmm. when it matters most, and when it also then, by being carried out in a fair way, does not contribute to incentives to come to this country improperly and in a dangerous way.
And before we go to phone calls, you talk about refugee status. I keep hearing asylum, that some of these young people may be eligible for asylum. Is there a difference between?
That's the same thing.
It's the same thing.
Yeah. They're seeking asylum in this country, and in order to be granted asylum, they need to be found eligible for refugee protection under the under U.S. law and international law.
And what makes you eligible for protection? If you're living in a community and there are gangs all over and they're going to kill you if you don't join a gang, does that make you eligible for refugee status?
Well, frankly, probably not. Mm. The definition of a refugee and the decision that needs to be made in these cases is whether a person has suffered or is likely to suffer persecution based on race, religion, ethnic origin, political opinion, or membership in a particular social group. Mm. Now, under these circumstances, generally people would claim the membership in a particular certain group element of the refugee definition, and that social group would be young people being preyed upon by gangs. But the prevailing precedent decisions that have been made by the Board of Immigration Appeals on these kinds of cases have generally not allowed for refugee status to be given or asylum to be given under just a general fear that there are gangs in my community. So this is by no means an easy or straightforward decision to make, and this is a flow and a group coming to the United States that tends to be a mixed flow, where some people will, in fact, be able to show individualized persecution. I mean, for instance, I've seen some cases written up where people have, in fact, been targeted. They have been beaten, whipped, extorted, etc. So they can show, and they have to show proof that in fact they have been individually targeted. But if they have a general fear, if they see that something's been going on in their community, that likely is not going to be sufficient for a judge to find them eligible for asylum in the United States. But these are individual decisions, and they do require an individual assessment, and we want to be sure to take care in making those decisions carefully.
Doris Meisner is our guest this hour. Doris is the former commissioner of the U.S. Immigration and Naturalization Service. She's a senior fellow right now at Migration Policy, where she directs that institute's U.S. immigration policy work. We're talking, of course, about the situation along the border. The president today asking Congress for $3.7 billion to deal with this. Doris has some and has written about what needs to happen in terms of upfront hearings for these young people. And we're wondering what your thoughts are about this. It really is, you know, one day it's $2 billion, then it's $3.7 billion, and there doesn't seem to be a concerted effort on the part of Congress and the president to get together and deal with this issue where you have so tens of thousands of young people, and it can't help but get you in your soul when you see these young children who are walking this long distance because they think they'll be coming to America and will be reunited with a relative. And there's no really strong policy or ideas here about what needs to be done, with everybody agreeing this is what needs to be done. What do you think? Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. You can leave messages there, and we're on Twitter at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Immigration this hour with Doris Meisner, and we're welcoming phone calls, 800-486-8655. Starting our calls with Marcus in Green Bay. Hi, Marcus.
Hello, and thanks for the program. Mm-hmm. I'm hoping that the guests could help me understand just what you said before the break and the president's decision not to go somewhere around the border and to get a firsthand feel of what's going on the borders. And the reason I'm so bewildered is with all the crises going on around the world, and this one's right in our own country. He's going to be right there. And if for no other reason than a photo op, he could appease maybe both sides finally, because there's many concerns all over about everything, you know, about this. But why on earth would he not go down the border just to learn, if not, like I say, for a photo op?
Right.
Just,
Doris, should he?
Well, I don't know whether he should or not. I mean, those kinds of trips, you know, tend to be, as you say, photo op trips. What I would say is that the administration actually has been doing an enormous amount of high-level work on this. I mean, the Secretary of Homeland Security, Jay Johnson, has been to the border numerous times on this issue. The head of the Domestic Policy Council, Cecilia Munoz, has been from the White House, has been on the border visiting Border Patrol stations, talking with migrants. The Vice President, Biden, called a really emergency meeting about a week and a half ago in Central America with the presidents of each of the countries. Secretary Kerry was in the region just last week, I believe, in Panama. I'm quite sure in Panama. Also with the Central American presidents on this issue. There's been a lot of high-level attention and direct involvement. Now, you know, could the president go? Should the president go? I don't know. I don't have an opinion on that. But senior people who are responsible for this issue and for dealing with it have this on their radar and are engaged in it, not only in a daily way, but have been there and have been involved. And so when the president says, or the president's press secretary, I think, said that he's been fully briefed, I think that we can take it as take it on good faith that indeed he is very familiar with the situation. Whether he should go there or not, to add to it, that's a call that they need to make.
Thank you, Marcus. Craig in Onalaska, hello.
Good afternoon. My concern is that, and the guest has just alluded to the high-level interactions of for example, the vice president. But it seems to me that the countries that are involved, and especially Mexico, have a moral obligation to stop a six-year-old from riding a train for 1,000 miles to get to this country. It's dangerous, and it seems to me that the U.S. should be putting tremendous pressure economically and every other way that they can on the governments of these countries. They should not be, you know, allowing people to get to the U.S. then creates our problems. And we should be trying to solve the problem at the source, not here.
No, I think you're raising, I think the caller raises a very good point, and I think that this issue, the more we learn or the more the public learns about the circumstances under which these young people come to the United States, it's appalling. And the mention of the train is as good an example as any of it. I mean, there is a well-developed train system through Mexico, basically starts at the border between Guatemala and Mexico. It's referred to as La Bestia, the beast. It is a beast because it is horribly dangerous. It's controlled by gangs. People are extorted as they get on the train and all along the way because the territory is carved up among the different contending criminal organizations. People ride atop these trains in huge numbers. If you see photographs of them, it's unbelievable that this would be allowed to be happening in plain daylight, as it were. So I believe that the caller is correct. This does require a whole set of responses, and they include, importantly, the countries of the region, Mexico as well as the source countries, Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala. And it is necessary to have a much higher level of coordination and attack on the criminal organizations and cooperation in order for this situation to change. Unfortunately, as we know, some of these things are longer term in being able to succeed. So one needs to have a set of responses, immediate, near term, and longer term. And in this case, it's particularly important not to fall back on the longer term responses, because unless we put those longer term responses into effect much more fully, we will live with these kinds of conditions in the future. And that, you know, we should not be comfortable with that.
Thank you, Craig. JM on Facebook, Dora says, these children obviously can't go back, but they can't be allowed in immediately. It's best to try and place them in detention centers suited to their needs. If we send them back and they end up getting harmed by what they were fleeing, I wonder if that would fuel anger in our nation.
Well, that's very important to focus on also, because naturally we certainly don't want to be returning vulnerable young people to dangerous circumstances without trying to help mitigate that. But, you know, the countries that we're talking about here are countries that are trying to establish democracies. They are countries that need help. They are not our enemies. This is not like the Cold War, when you didn't have a relationship with the Soviet Union and people came from the country and there was no way to work with the country. These are countries that are our allies, and they're countries that are in our neighborhood. We have important shared interests. So we should be working with them, and they should be coming to the table to help receive people back that are to be returned, and work on reintegration projects and work on safe placements. And if the placement, if where they came from is truly an unsafe place to be, there should be the ability for them to be in the hands, for the young people to be in the hands of social services agencies and resources in other parts of the country. I mean, when we think of our own country, when we think of countries all around the world, there are unsafe conditions in many places. It's unfortunate, but it exists. However, one would hope that there are mitigating institutions and ways to be of assistance. We need to help these countries, and these countries need to be willing to make the effort with us to create those kinds of interventions for young people.
Mm-hmm. John is next in Dunn. Hi, John.
Hi. I have a couple of questions. One is, she spoke earlier about proof of the danger to that person, that individual back in the country it came from. And what sort of proof is required? But part of that question is also the juries or the justices that rule on whether or not the proof is adequate. You know, we know that most of the...
Well, we lost your phone call. Can you gather enough from that, Doris, to carry on?
Yeah, I probably can. Okay. In terms of the proof. I'm not sure where he was going with the judges, but on the proof itself, the proof, of course, is difficult, and I think that was probably one of the things that he was inferring. There is, however, a well-developed way of dealing with proof. There is... It points most importantly to why it's so important to have lawyers defending these young people, or lawyers, let's say, representing these young people before immigration judges, because it's the lawyers who represent the young people that help to figure out what the proof might be. And generally, the proof deals with what's known as both objective and subjective circumstances. The objective circumstances is what it is that we know about the countries. And in this case, we do know that in these countries there is gang violence, there are cartels, there is recruitment of young people, and so on. So where the objective circumstances are concerned, we know that there are problems. But we also know that those problems exist much more intensively in some parts of the country than in other parts of the country. So it's not like it's a one-size-fits-all. And I don't mean to be glib about it, but there are differences, just like there are in communities anywhere else, as to where there are safe areas and areas that are not so safe. Mm-hmm. So there's all of that objective information that is available through human rights reporting that takes place in countries, through press reporting that takes place, through country conditions work that is done by the State Department, for instance. And then there are the subjective factors, which is what it is that that person actually experienced. And there one has to be skillful at being able to interview, particularly where children are concerned. You have the language capability, and you have to be able to find out what the child actually experienced. The work of immigration judges and the work of asylum officers and others who have been in this field for years has developed to a point where it is possible to put together that kind of a picture. And it can be done. It just requires the resources to do it, and it can be done. You know, it doesn't need to take forever, but the effort has to be applied, and the resources need to be mobilized.
Right. Yeah, and you need resources. In terms of what's going on right now, Doris, it would appear to me that you've got tens of thousands of children, some adults, but mostly children, who are in these detention facilities in various places, not only along the border. I guess it goes as far as Virginia. You don't have a clear policy about reuniting with families, and you've got people in various communities screaming at these busloads of people who are coming into the country saying, go back home. You don't have that upfront hearing at this point in time. You don't have Congress taking action on it. So what in the world is going on? Are you just going to have tens of thousands of people, young people, in detention? Because you're going to create an uproar and more people coming into the country if you reunite them with families. What do we do?
Well, actually, there is a very clear policy where families are concerned. And the clear policy is that that young people are to be released to the care of their families if their families are safe places for them to be. And so that's what's been happening. I mean,
right.
85 to 90% of these young people over the last year to 2 years where these numbers have been increasing, 85 to 90% of these young people are, in fact, released to the care of a family member.
In the United States.
In the United States.
Okay.
That is how deeply this is intertwined with family members that are in the United States and families that are separated across countries because of what's been going on in general, most predominantly where illegal immigration is concerned. So that people have been being released to families, they're continuing to be released to families. That will only begin to abate as the resources for much more timely hearings at the front end begin to be put into place. What that means is that these kinds of uproars that the news that we saw last week of this community in California that had an uproar about buses rolling into the community, they were having an uproar about entirely the wrong thing because those people were not going to be released into their community. They were just being brought there for processing. In order to determine where there might be family members, sorting out who where the adult family members might be, providing temporary shelter, etc. But it is true then that when young people are released to their family members, they are in communities that are already immigrant communities. I mean, that's, after all, where their family members live. And so in those communities that already have large immigrant populations and predominantly unauthorized immigrant populations, there will be more stress on the school systems, on the healthcare systems in particular, because there are numbers of people being added to already existing households. So there certainly are implications and there certainly are pressures, but not likely in the communities where the processing is taking place.
Well, you say that most of them will come and be reunited with family members. Why then would the White House press secretary say yesterday that most unaccompanied minors attempting to enter the U.S. on the southern border will likely not qualify for humanitarian relief and will be deported?
Well, because they are shifting, I mean, they're putting the procedures and a system into place to make those decisions much more readily. I'm describing the way it works now.
Right.
And these circumstances that lead to hearings 2 and 3 years down the road. But as the wherewithal, as the resources get put into place to carry out those decision processes in combination with the arrival of young people in the country, then you will start to see that shift so that return on a fairly readily after people have first arrived in the country, that would then start to come into play.
It is amazing to me, Doris, that nobody really knows what the policy is going to be. So you make this long trek at the expense of losing your life to come to the country that where you have been able to reunite with your family, and now all of a sudden, because so many are there, you can't do that anymore and you get sent back. For heaven's sake, let's have a policy that everybody knows what the policy is.
Well, I mean, I certainly would underscore that the administration has not been, until the last several days, particularly clear about what it is that it's going to do. But it's also been really, really just coping with building capacity and trying to figure out what to do with these large numbers. You have to expect that there will be some delay in there being absolutely clear on how they're going to proceed.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think that the policy that the official policy, I mean, the policy as it is stated by government officials is of course, important in terms of the public understanding, negotiations with the countries from which these people come, etc. But that is a different thing, and the administration's been doing, the executive branch has been doing a lot to telegraph throughout the region that this is dangerous, you shouldn't come, you're not going to be allowed to stay, and those are all important responses. But until the actual experience that people have once they've arrived, until that experience changes, that's not real to the people who are taking
right.
the risk.
Right, I understand. Doris Meisner is our guest this hour. We have a few minutes left here. She's the former commissioner of the U.S. Immigration and Naturalization Service. She is now senior fellow at an organization that is also dealing with immigration issues. It's the Migration Policy Institute, and there she directs the U.S. immigration policy work. More phone calls momentarily. We'll get through as many as we can. 800-486-8655 is the number. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go back to phone calls. Ben in Green Bay. Hi.
Hi, I used to be an immigration counselor for Catholic Charities, and we're a nonprofit. It's a nationwide nonprofit. But again, we were able to help people and give them, the most amount of information, the best information, the correct information, at very little cost. Now, one of the biggest problems was there were notarios, otherwise known, Spanish or immigrant community. They call them lawyers, but they're really not lawyers. How would we ensure that once they're in the system, that they're being represented adequately? Is any of the money that's been requested by President Obama being requested to subsidize public defenders? Because there's really no public defender system, as far as I'm aware. There wasn't one. I was an immigration counselor to represent people in the immigration court.
Doris.
Well, the caller makes a very, very good point, and I'm very familiar with the organization that he worked for. They do outstanding work, and it's exactly that kind of work that is necessary in these situations and that are a part of a good immigration judge hearing system. I must say that I have not seen, to the degree that I've been able to understand what's in this appropriations request, I don't see funding for representation. What is being asked for is what's referred to as immigration judge teams. That may include some opportunity for representation because the statute that is the guiding statute here is clear that young people should be represented. And they're in all of the other child legal proceedings that take place in our system, children always are represented. So it really makes the overall hearing go much more expeditiously if there is representation. But it's also true that the Justice Department announced about two, 3 weeks ago that it was putting several million dollars into defense funding for defense attorneys, that it was looking for AmeriCorps kind of assistance of young lawyers spending a year in border settings helping to defend and prepare cases for immigration judges like this. There have been, by organizations that provide pro bono, I'm told, a tremendous outpouring from big law firms all around the country asking whether they could please provide pro bono help because of the sympathetic circumstances that are represented by this flow. Pulling together the legal resources is a big job, but it also is part of the mobilization that would be required to do this job correctly.
Yeah.
And the caller is exactly right. You do not want to leave this to the notarios. This needs to be done by trained lawyers.
Thank you, Ben. Margot in Linksville. Hello.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have a statement to make and then a question. What about the gang and dangers in our own country? I am not isolationist by any stretch of the imagination, but the United States has become mother to the world. When do these countries become responsible? If they want democracy, the people, if they want it badly enough, will get their democracy. I don't understand. We have 85 people that were shot and wounded in Chicago over the weekend, gang-related, that we can't take care of. And I'm wondering, why do we have to be, and I care about these people. I have compassion for them. But when does the United States and all our lovely lawyers and politicians put pressure on these countries to be responsible for their own people instead of shipping them off to America?
All right, Doris.
It's a very important point, and I think that it goes to what we were talking about earlier, which is the importance of these countries if they expect to be responsible partners and ultimately be democratic systems, of being able to provide opportunities and provide safety. Safety being, you know, one of the most fundamental responsibilities of government. As the caller also says, this is something that societies like ours struggle with as well. So the solutions here are not simply to bring in all of the young people that are now coming to the border. This is a situation that is not defensible. It cannot be sustained. But the answers to it are across many different areas of response. They include treating the people who are here properly, but at the same time working to reduce the circumstances and change the dynamics in the countries themselves of why it is that people are leaving, just as we deal with changing the incentives in this country that are bringing them here. Mm-hmm. It's going to require a broad range of solutions, and the policies that are being put into place involving the Secretary of State, involving the Vice President, talking with the countries in the region, creating both pressure as well as support for them to develop the capacities to take care of their people. All those aspects of the issue are going to be required in order to change it.
Doris, let's draw from your experience as Commissioner of U.S. Immigration and Naturalization. I know you dealt with Haitian and Cuban flows in the 1990s. What is pertinent to a discussion today from those flows of people, and what did you learn during that experience that would benefit us now?
Well, I'm very much influenced in my opinion about these issues by those experiences in the 1990s, and what I learned is basically what I've been talking about here, which is that you need immediate responses that begin to change the dynamics of the flow, because you cannot allow these flows to continue in this dangerous, unregulated manner. You need medium-term responses that rectify the loophole, or not the loopholes, I would say the weaknesses in your own system, in this case, the long delays in immigration hearings, and you need longer-term solutions, which is changes in the conditions that are driving people from the countries. So, you know, in many ways, one way to look at this is to say that, you know, one should never let a crisis go unanswered in terms of the issues that it brings to the table and what it tells us about how we have to change in order to not have those emergencies happen in the future. And that's basically the basis that we've been covering in this conversation.
Mm-hmm. Doris, thank you very much for being with us. We didn't even get to, we had so many phone calls and emails, but you know that. There's a lot of people who think a lot of things about this issue. We appreciate your time spent in the area and this hour. Thanks.
Thank you.
Doris Meisner, former commissioner of the U.S. Immigration and Naturalization Service, now senior fellow at Migration Policy Institute. She directs the U.S. immigration policy work. And she's done a great deal of work in the 90s, reforming the nation's asylum system, looking at the issues we talked about, services for immigrants, new responses to migration and humanitarian emergencies, and strengthening cooperation with Mexico, Canada, and other countries. Some interesting Facebook comments. We urge that you go to our page, the Kathleen Dunn Show. We couldn't get to all of them, and they're worth reading. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this hour, and thanks to KP as well for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. News coming up from National Public Radio, and we will return.